back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Hello and welcome back to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise, and thank you all for staying tuned to the show. If you've been enjoying the programming so far, please do mark this show as a favorite. And so at the bottom of the hour, we announced the question of the day, which is brought to you by the Institute of Applied Energetics, and I will re-announce the question of the day after the next station break. But now we have a different guest on. We're going to be talking with Stephen Myers about the lost technologies of the Great Pyramids. So let me tell you a little bit about Stephen, and we're going to get him on the air and continue our conversation about ancient mysteries. Author, lecturer, and independent researcher Stephen Myers has studied the Great Pyramid for over 20 years to understand how this ancient wonder of the world was built and why. His research included traveling to Egypt to conduct extensive on-site research at the Giza Plateau. So please welcome to Just Energy Radio the author of the Lost Pyramids, or Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramids, Stephen Myers. Hey, Stephen, how are you?
I'm just great. Thank you for this opportunity, Rita.
Well, thanks for coming on the show and sharing your insights and wisdom with the listeners. You know, we just did a show on Atlantis in 2012, and I was like, you know, it just kind of makes a nice meshing when you have kind of a theme going on.
Oh, yes.
Let's start here, Stephen. How did you get involved with studying the pyramids? What sparked your interest in understanding how the pyramids were built?
Well, I have a very technical background in my education. And I enjoy technology of all ages, Middle Ages armor and World War II technology, that type of thing. I'm also an amateur radio operator, so even my hobbies have a technical nature. And if you like technology and history, ultimately your focus of interest will go to the Great Pyramid because it's one of the technical wonders in all of history. So that's how I got interested in it. And being technically inclined, I was interested in how it was built. You know, it's a big pile of rocks. How did that pile get from the quarries to where they ended up? So that's where my interest lies. And that's what I studied and ultimately wrote a book, Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid, about how the Great Pyramid was built.
Cool. Before we talk about the construction part, I wanted to talk about what the pyramid was for. I mean, contemporary Egyptology says that the pyramid was built as a tomb for the Emperor Cheops, and, you know, thousands of workers dragged the tombs, the stones over there with wooden ramps, which I'm sure we're going to talk about that part. But what was it made for? Do you, you know, why build it? I mean, other than they will come, but why build it in the first place?
Sure. Yeah, certainly Egyptologists have an interpretation of the direct physical evidence that remains, which is the Great Pyramid itself. And they have offered an explanation, which is that it was a tomb for a pharaoh. But we don't think that. I'm the founder of a nonprofit foundation that's studying the Great Pyramid in terms of its technology. And we think that the purpose of the Great Pyramid was that it was infrastructure for the civilization that built it. It was a functioning machine. That is one reason why there's such precision in its construction. And the machine functioned to pump water. And that's what we think the Great Pyramid was, a functioning machine to pump water.
You know, one of the things we're doing a new giveaway thing, and what we're giving away this week is the Pyramid Code by Carmen Boulder. I mean, not to interrupt you,
no,
but
one
of the things, when I had her on the show and asked her, I have always been curious about the whole tomb idea, because if in the 1800s or the 1700s they had to blast their way in to get into the pyramid to find out the internal structures, then how did the tomb robbers get in there in the first place to steal everything? And she
correct.
Said, well, there was no way in. And the hole that they blew into the side of the pyramid was the hole, and so what they found was what was in there, which was nothing.
Nothing, that's correct. Yeah, historical records indicates that it was devoid of any treasure, any mummy, anything, that it was pretty much a bunch of empty rooms with some oddly shaped passages. So, but we think that it was, again, a functioning device, and you didn't need any tombs. You didn't need any interior writing. Gasoline engines don't have writing inside the cylinders. You know, they're a functioning device that don't need writing. And the Great Pyramid is devoid of writing. Much of the structures in ancient Egypt have writing all over them, inside and out. But the Great Pyramid doesn't, because it doesn't need any writing. So yes, there were no artifacts of any kind. The only thing that's in the Great Pyramid now is a coffer, a box without a lid.
Right, the granite box that they can't quite figure out what that's for either.
Correct.
How did you come up with the idea or the thought that the pyramid was a water pump in the first place? I mean, that just, you know, it falls outside of mainstream, like way outside of mainstream Egyptology. But what kind of evidence did you find that led you to come up with that theory?
I appreciate that. Just because something is different than what everybody thinks doesn't make it incorrect. Like, some people thought that the world was round, and that was quite a bit different than what everybody thought. And there was a guy that thought that the mold on bread, instead of just throwing it away, maybe it'll help people get well. And that guy was Alexander Fleming, who developed penicillin. So having an unusual idea doesn't make it incorrect. But we studied the Great Pyramid with an open slate, just trying to understand, just the actual real technical requirements to build it, and conducting research. Much of the research that is available from Egyptology, they have their ideas, but they don't offer any demonstrations to substantiate their ideas. It's interesting that the casing stones on the outside are made very precise, and Egyptologists say that was done using hand tools. Well, it's never been demonstrated. That's kind of interesting. And also a stone the size of the casing stones has never been moved around the corner of a spiral ramp. So there's much of the ideas that Egyptologists have aren't accompanied with demonstrative proof, let me put it that way. But after finding out that Egyptology has a lot of problems to overcome, I read alternative books, and there were a lot of alternative books out there, different ideas about Bible prophecy and ancient engineering, but I found this small book written by a fellow. He privately published his book, and it's quite rare, and that book is called Pharaoh's Pump, and it talks about how the Great Pyramid was built, and also that it was a water pump. So much of the research of our foundation is based on the work conducted by this independent researcher who's now passed away, named Edward Kunkel. So that's where I got that idea. Well, he passed away in the mid-1980s, and our foundation has conducted a body of research that has been compiled into this book that I've written. So it advances much of his research and discusses how these stones can be moved in the real world, how they actually really were moved, instead of an idea of a big ramp that was of a bigger size than the Great Pyramid. or any of these other ideas that Egyptologists can't seem to demonstrate.
My favorite is the wooden roller thing, and it's like, hello, there aren't any trees in Egypt.
That's true.
They had to import the trees to roll the things, and then when they do the little demonstrations on TV, it's a rock that's the size of a chair, and they barely can even move that.
That is correct. That is very astute on your part. They often will use the itty-bittiest or smallest stones to move, and then say that's how the largest stones were moved. Well, that's kind of a bait and switch, or a fast shuffle of the evidence type of thing, and it's not really scientifically appropriate to do that, if I may say so myself. So instead of just believing what Egyptologists say, we have done our research, and we feel that the stones were moved on barges from the Nile all the way up to the building site on water locks, similar to locks in the Panama Canal or the Erie Canal. And that way they were brought all the way up to the building site easily and efficiently.
So can you kind of, I've been led to believe that the Nile actually was much closer at one point in time to the pyramid. So I totally can wrap my mind around, okay, there at least was water for them
mm-hmm.
to use. But
yeah.
How did they get water all the way over to the building site? I mean, because obviously it wasn't just, the pyramid wasn't built on, seafront property, on the beach. Well, never mind, that was bad.
Well, there's scholarly debate as to the location of the Nile back when the Great Pyramid was built. And many scholars believe that it was much closer. But a series of canals and water locks from the Nile all the way over to all the way up to the building site would allow the stones to be moved all the way to the building site. And then imagine, if you will, the first layer of casing stones, the stones that went around outside the Great Pyramid, if they were set in place first and they're cemented together watertight, and then if that area was filled in with water, you'd have a square pond up on the Giza Plateau. And if you had a water lock from that pond, a series of locks, from that pond all the way to the Nile, you could bring stones up all the way to that pond and then move the stones off the barge and set them into the pond. And when that pond was filled up, the first level of the Great Pyramid would be completed. And that's a synopsis of how we feel the Great Pyramid was built.
I mean, I just think that's such an interesting concept to even think about. I don't think anybody would even think that. If
true.
That made sense at all.
Yes, it does. It's an unusual idea, but it's interesting that Herodotus, the 5th century B.C. historian, when he went and visited the Great Pyramid, he talked to the priests, which were probably tour guides. But anyway, he talked to people, and they suggested that it was machines that moved the stones on barges, that moved the stones, and the machines were made out of short wooden planks. And water locks, the lock gates, the doors, they are usually made out of short wooden planks. So even Herodotus, the 5th century B.C. historian, he wasn't told about a big ramp. Back then, they understood that there was some type of machine to move the stones. Most people interpret the use of short wooden planks as being levers, but the size of the stones don't allow levers to be, an effective way to move the stones. So water locks, in effect, are a machine that allow stones to be lifted and moved up to a higher elevation.
And there is precedence in other areas, not with the construction, you know, but with the moving part in other cultures where if they have to take big stones long distances, or you hear about obelisks being transported down the Nile on barges, and so having a barge move the stone over to the pyramid site doesn't seem that far out there.
No, it's not that far-fetched. Most of the quarries...
It kind of makes more sense than the roller thing.
Well, I'll tell you a little idea. The roller idea is wonderful if you can actually do it. If it can be done in the real world, then that's the way it was. Then that's a possibility, let me put it that way. But the roller idea, if you have wooden rollers and a 16-ton stone on top of them, the rollers will sink into the sand, or even and if the rollers are on a ramp that's made out of stone, the wooden rollers will be crushed. It can't work. And the reason why Egyptologists don't demonstrate how a 16-ton stone was moved, they have never moved the whole science of Egyptology has never moved a 16-ton stone 1 inch ever in the last 200 years of Egyptology. And there's a reason for it. The reason is that it is not possible to do. They can write their books in every library in the world that tell stories of people dragging stones up ramps, but full-size stones they have never moved because it can't be done in the real world. It's interesting to note that the Erie Canal was a 4.5-foot deep ditch when built. The barges were able to hold a 70-ton payload. So if you have a 4.5-foot deep ditch and some water locks and some canals, you can easily move 70-ton payloads.
And see, that was one of my questions, because one of the things you talk about in the book is that the water was like chest high, or you know, that you could walk through, you know, and not drown. And I was, and so in my mind, I'm going, well, how do you have this like multiple ton stone on a barge? And I'm thinking, okay, you know, it's long, and you know, you'll get a certain amount of displacement that's going to happen because of the size of the barge with relationship to the stone on it. But it just didn't seem like it would be deep enough. But I guess it would be.
Yes, it is. It is. And since they built it level by level, they completed an entire level, and then they built the level on top using water locks and the top casing stones impounded a pond. So each level is only about waist deep, and that's plenty deep enough to move very heavy payloads. The book has a number of illustrations that help illustrate this sequence of construction. Most Egyptologists say the Great Pyramid was built similar to how we see it now, and then the casing stones were put on top, on the outside, a sheathing, if you will, of casing stones. That's incorrect. Many Egyptologists feel that the sequence was level by level, and I concur with that based on a whole series of evidences that are indicated in the book. So that's how it was constructed, and it gives glory to the ancient people that they were not knuckle draggers, but that they were very efficient and geniuses in the way that they built this magnificent structure. So that's what we're trying to get out, is this alternative idea about the Great Pyramid.
One of the things that you've mentioned several times is this lock system. Mm-hmm. And so for the listeners, can you explain in a little bit more detail what that means, what that entails as far as getting the stones to move across and moving them up different levels, et cetera, et cetera? I don't know that everyone is familiar with that concept.
Oh, certainly. Water locks, like the Panama Canal, a modern wonder of the world, or the Erie Canal, a barge will go into this enclosure that has doors on both sides. Water will fill that enclosure, and rise the boat and payload up. And then it'll go out the other set of doors, and it'll be raised to a new level. So if you have a series of water locks, which is called a flight, similar to a flight of stairs, the barge will go into a water lock, raise up, go into the next one and raise up, and it's the choice technology used in the 21st century to move our heaviest payloads. The new dam in China, the Three Gorges Dam, is going to be the largest structure on Earth, and it will use water locks to move ships past the dam. They'll go into a water lock, raise up, and then go into the pond impounded by the dam. It's probably a big lake, actually. But so it's an efficient use of energy, materials, whatever. And that's how ships go through the Panama Canal instead of all the way around South America. And it's a wonderful technology. It's very simple, and it's also why we call the book The Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid, because it's the technology of water locks isn't lost, but what's lost is the understanding that ancient mankind was utilized those water locks to build the Great Pyramid.
Well, and I think when current scientists, archaeologists, Egyptologists, and when I say current, I'm going to say like the last 300 years, and that's being very kind.
Mm-hmm.
Look at that area. I mean, all they see is sand. And so even having the concept that there could be any kind of water involvement, I don't think that they would even think that or start there or make a connection. But I think it's just in kind of recent years that there has been commentary and evidence that there actually was water.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a question. Your book made me think about a lot of different things. One of the things that there has been conversation about, Robert Schlock, talked about the weathering of the Sphinx and, the water weathering of the Sphinx. And one of the things, if I'm not mistaken, you dated the pyramid kind of with contemporary timeline, about 3000 BC, 3500 BC. Why not actually date it further back when there was even a larger abundance of water in that area?
Okay, I appreciate all of that. Herodotus described...
Sorry.
Okay, that's okay. There's a lot of stuff in that question. Herodotus, when he went to the Great Pyramid, he described them as being surrounded by water, the Great Pyramid. And that he also says that there was a conduit, an artificial duct, connected to the Great Pyramid. So in very ancient times, there was a lot of talk about water on the Giza Plateau. We also talked about a lot of channels, canals, that type of thing in that area. And in Roman times, okay, we've moved way up. Roman times, a lot of the Roman soldiers would march to Egypt because Rome was controlled Egypt. They walked in the shade. So there was a lot of trees at that time, believe it or not, in between where they went from Rome to Egypt. I'm making this all very, very quick. But in modern times, the last 400 years, all they say is, well, there's a bunch of sand out there, and let's see if we can find some mummies to take. And that's Egyptologists. There hasn't been any research looking for a lot of the water evidence that Herodotus spoke about, because there's no gain in it. There's no mummy or golden treasure to put in a museum to get people to pay to go see.
And so I'm going to assume that Herodotus was Greek, basically.
Yes, he was Greek.
And so when was he around?
5th century BC. And he talked a lot about water on the Giza Plateau. But now all people look at it, oh, it's a bunch of sand and dry, that type of thing. So in ancient times, in the Sahara Desert, it was considered to be more of a savanna, if you will. There's rock drawings of gazelle and giraffe, that type of thing. So things change. What I'm saying is now, certainly there's a lot of sand and it's very dry in that area. But the weather pattern changes, rainfall changes, that type of thing. So it was a number of researchers say that the weather and water and things were, the position of the Nile was much different back in earlier times. As for the date when the Great Pyramid was built, that's certainly up to conjecture by many scholars. I don't address it very much because it's not as significant as a number of other factors. But I feel that it was probably contemporary with the Sphinx. A lot of people do. But just until Robert Schock, who I met, did his research talking about water weathering, because the like 12,000 years ago, there was much more water, and even before the last ice age. So that puts the Sphinx much, much farther back, which I concur with his research, stellar research in that regard. But also the Great Pyramid possibly could have been built a long time earlier than is indicated by Egyptologists. They feel that it was about 4,000 years ago, but it could have predated all the other pyramids in the Nile Valley.
Well, you know, there's what they say, and then there's what everybody believes, or
mm-hmm.
what I believe, which is what they say. I mean, because what they say doesn't make any sense. So,
we're
totally cool there.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I had another question about. Oh, yeah, because we're going to go to a break here in a couple of minutes. What I've never heard the information from Herodotus. Why is it just totally overlooked, or how come no one? This is the first time I've ever heard references to water on the Giza Plateau, or, you know, from a historical perspective, you know, mm-hmm. or channels with water on the Giza Plateau. Why has everybody else just totally overlooked him and his work?
Well, some people say some people say that some of his observations were in error, that type of thing. But he certainly was an eyewitness to the Great Pyramid when it was much much newer, but it was still ancient in his day. So his eyewitness accounts of certainly some of them are anecdotal, if you will, but at least when he talks about water and talks about canals, it is eye-opening, that's for sure. Herodotus, Histories, Book 2, if anyone's interested. But we think that much of the Great Pyramid's construction was excellent high technology that can't be reproduced today.
I concur. There's the music, which means we need to take a quick break. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. We're here talking to Stephen Myers about his book, The Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid. His website is thepump.org. And when we come back, I will tell you the question of the week. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. We'll be back after.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
Life and discover alternative solutions to your deepest concerns at SoulHealer.com. So whether it's a physical problem, an emotional issue, a question about work, or troubles in your relationships, naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise can help you. Bring peace, harmony, and health back into your life. Schedule a session today. Visit SoulHealer.com right away and live the life you've been dreaming of.
Hi, I'm James Othayanchik.
the Black Knight of Talk Radio. Listen to Dr. Rita's Soul Healer Moment live each third Sunday night of the month on Feet to the Fire. www.feettofire.com for more information.
Hi, I'm Dr. Rita Louise, the host of Just Energy Radio and the founder of the Institute of Applied Energetics. Start a new career today on the leading edge of alternative health and healing. The Institute of Applied Energetics can help you develop the specialized skills you need to work as an energy medicine practitioner, intuitive counselor, or professional medical intuitive. Besides our outstanding technical instruction, our programs also support you in creating and building a successful business in this rapidly growing field. Be a catalyst for changing the way healthcare is done around the world. Contact the Institute of Applied Energetics right away or visit AppliedEnergeticsInstitute.com.
How would you like to live long and enjoy great health? How about creating solid bones and whiter teeth? Strengthen your heart and eyes and have radiant, youthful-looking skin. There is an ancient health and longevity secret that has been used for millennia in Egypt, India, and China that can help you achieve this. For the first time in the modern world, Pearlseum brings this ancient wellness secret to you. For more information about Pearlseum, visit www.productsforthesoul.com.
And now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Hello and welcome back to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise, and here is the question of the week. The winner and the person who turns in the first correct answer to this question will win a copy of The Pyramid Code, a two-disc but 5-hour DVD series by Karen Baldair. It's a really excellent show. So to enter, go to www.justenergyradio.com, click the contact button, and you can enter the contest. So here's this week's question. This incredibly ancient Egyptian god was the original god of the dead before Osiris took over the position. So go ahead and enter, because you can only win if you enter. And we're going to get back to Stephen and keep talking about the lost technologies of the Great Pyramid. Hey, Stephen.
Hi.
You still with me?
Oh, I'm okay. With you all the way.
You're with me all the way.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I have another hard question for you. Sorry, I got hard questions for you.
Oh, go for it.
It's a technical question. Okay, I totally get water, barge, get the rocks over to the building. I get that. But once they get there, you talk about they build the first layer of casing stones, but now you have this giant empty hole. You know, and I know we used to have an above ground pool when I was a kid, and periodically there were a couple of summers that we basically had to bail the entire pool out because it would only siphon so far, so there might have been like a foot of water in the bottom that we would hand bucket out. So I know about getting the water out. How did they get the water in?
Okay. I'm glad you asked me that. One of the first things that they did to build the Great Pyramid, most people agree with this, is they built passages and a chamber in the solid rock. The chamber is fairly large, and it's down in below the Great Pyramid, about 100 feet. And the descending passage travels down to that passage to the subterranean chamber down there, and there's some other odd passages down there, a dead-end passage, there's a hole in the pit, and a few other things. And we feel that those cuttings built before the Great Pyramid was built was a type of water pump in and of itself. So the Great Pyramid, with water at the building site, allowed water to enter those passages and that chamber deep below the Great Pyramid, and it pumped water to keep that pond full. So the pond would stay full during construction And it would also supply water for the water locks. The uppermost water lock needed water that would travel. The water would travel down the water locks, and the barges with stones would travel up the water locks. So there's a similar type of technology used in modern times called a hydraulic ram water pump. Although the two pumps aren't exactly the same, it gives you an idea of the similarities of those two types of pumps. But anyway, that's what kept the pond full and supplied the water locks was the pump underneath the Great Pyramid.
And this was like a natural pump, kind of like a natural spring on overdrive kind of thing. I guess you kind of lost me there.
All right, I hear you. It is technical in nature, but water would travel down the descending passage into the subterranean chamber, and ultimately that would compress air in the subterranean chamber. That's about 88 tons of water traveling down the descending passage, and that compressed air was used ultimately to pump water up through a grotto and up through the mound that the Great Pyramid was built on and supplied water for the construction process. Before rural electrification, farms and out in the country, they had pumps that would pump water from a spring. It would be spring-fed, and then without electricity, it would pump water up higher than the pump. And the pump underneath the Great Pyramid operated very similarly to that. So that's how they were able to keep the pump, every level they built, level by level, as it went up, there was still a pond, a waist-deep pond above the construction. And then that pond was kept full by that pump under the Great Pyramid.
I live in Texas, and they have, like, water towers everywhere, which, from what I understand, they actually help maintain water pressure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's a true statement. That's what somebody told me, because I'm like, what are these things, and why are they here? And so even though we're not talking about the same exact thing, we're kind of talking about a kind of similar concept.
Yeah, sort of, kind of. Yes, they are. It's
in a more contemporary kind of way.
Yeah. Those tanks are, you know, they work well, and they help infrastructure, you know, for our civilization, as the Great Pyramid was infrastructure for an ancient civilization. The Great Pyramid wasn't a water tank because it's solid stone, in effect, and it pumped water as opposed to those water towers you're talking about. So water is an important aspect of civilizations, and we feel that the ancient civilization that built the Great Pyramid had a high understanding of physics and a very profound knowledge of the world around them, and were able to develop technology from this high understanding to make this unique and efficient water pump. The fundamental purpose of our foundation is to redevelop that ancient but lost technology and use it in modern times. It can be an alternative to using oil products to make electricity. It can also help third world countries irrigate farmland that they wouldn't be able to without this efficient water pump. And also, if you have a way to pump water efficiently, that pumped water can be used to generate electricity. So those applications, besides just what happened when the Great Pyramid was built, those technical applications for our modern but troubled world is what our foundation is really trying to develop.
Let's kind of shift gears here and talk about some of the internal structures in the pyramid.
Certainly.
I mean, there was how it was built, because as you were talking, I'm going, okay, there were those little passages that they said, oh, well, that's how they looked at Venus and whatever, you know. It aligns with Venus, although when they sent the little probe down there, there are all these, like, walls or blockages that wouldn't let the little probe go down. You know, what kind of came to me was that a chamber that actually allowed water to travel up from one level to another during construction?
Yeah, there are
kind
some
of making
vents.
It up.
No, there's vents in the Great Pyramid, two that exit the King's Chamber. And they go up and they do point up. There's a lot of theories that they were like star gazers or something to that effect, or to plot significant stars that the soul of the pharaoh could go to and all of that. There's a lot of things on the internet and books written about that. But we feel that they were the output shafts from the King's Chamber is where the water exited the pump. And, you know, there's a lot of ideas. One interesting feature of those shafts is they're where they exit the Great Pyramid, they're both at the same elevation, the same level, if you will. So so that's kind of interesting for a water application. But that's the water went in the descending passage and then came out the King's Chamber vents. And then the water was utilized for any number of applications. The Giza Plateau, to me, seems more like a industrial park than a graveyard. And they could have done scientific experiments. With pumped water, you can power machinery, you can create compressed air, do a whole bunch of scientific and industrial applications besides irrigation.
And so then what was the King's Chamber for? You know, like the Grand Gallery and the King's Chamber used for?
Okay. The Grand Gallery was built very precise. If it's that big chamber that kind of goes up at an angle, and if it wasn't already in a wonder of the world, it would be a wonder of the world. It's, seriously, it's the stones are bonded together with a controversial bonding agent that is stronger than the stones itself. That is a marvel in itself. But anyway. It was like an airtight chamber that we feel was used as a massive water piston, and it was this chamber was about a third full of water, and then we feel that based on a tremendous amount of research that a vacuum was created above this one third of water in this chamber, which helped lift that water up. And then when that vacuum was released, there was a massive amount of water, about 100 tons of water, moved back down. And that movement of water was a hydraulic force which moved water into the Queen's Chamber and compressed air in the Queen's Chamber, in the upper half of the Queen's Chamber. This is the technical aspects. And then ultimately the same thing happened in the King's Chamber. And then that compressed air in the King's Chamber forced the water out the King's Chamber vents. And there's a lot of applications in the real world of similar types of machinery that's kind of in series, you know, that has chambers in series. Marine steam engines had three pistons in series. The first piston, the steam was used to move that piston, and then that same steam was used to move the next two pistons in series, and ultimately was quite efficient. So in a similar way, that hints of the genius of the Great Pyramid and their Great Pyramid water pump.
I just think that that's just so... It gets so technical that I'm sitting here in my mind. That's why there was this kind of delay, because I'm going...
Okay, I appreciate that.
Air, water. Here's the passage. I mean, you know, I have to admit, you know, I've I'm very interested in Egyptology, so I'm very familiar with like the little schematic of the inside, and so it's you know, and I have a mechanical background, mechanical engineering background, so it's kind of like.
Yeah, I appreciate all of that. You got to remember the Great Pyramid has got like about five major chambers and all these passages, and for a single dead guy. And Egyptologists acknowledge that the Great Pyramid doesn't look like a tomb. So they say, well, since it doesn't look like a tomb, there must have been some design changes as it was being built, because it doesn't look like what they want it to look like. So the complexity of the Great Pyramid all has a purpose, and that purpose is to be infrastructure and pump water, similar to the complexity underneath the hood of a car is to make the car go. So the interest is really high about all of this because people are focusing on the advantages of some of these the ancient technologies that we're talking about and adapting them to help our modern but troubled world. You'd be surprised the people that that are interested in this. Moms of soldiers that are over in Afghanistan and in the Middle East are very interested. I've had quite a few say, wow, can we get off of our addiction to oil by having this alternative energy source? And I say that's what we're trying to develop the best we can with what we have to work with. We're a small nonprofit foundation with limited resources, but we want to develop that technology. So every time we go to the, you know, we go to the gas station and fill up, and I euphemistically call that funding the terrorists. Because that money goes back to the Middle East, part of it. So if we can develop ways to charge electric batteries for cars in a different manner, or if we can reduce our dependency on hydropower by making more dams, maybe we can have a cleaner environment, a safer world, and that type of thing. Also, the cost of energy is directly related to a civilization's prosperity. I read a book, and I wish I had the reference, but it talked. It said that if the cost of energy quadruples, then the standard of living is cut in half. And everyone you know is struggling financially with, you know, paying for you know, the energy is a factor for everything, the cost of food and all of that. If we can reduce the cost to irrigate farmland with an alternative water pumping system, you know, our food will be less and that type of thing. So that's what we're all about, not just a dusty pile of rocks that's really academic, but we think that an ancient civilization developed technology that transformed hardship into prosperity. And we think that in modern times, we need to develop this ancient technology to help our modern but troubled world.
I'll agree. So does it really focus on using water power, or is it pretty much open to any kind of alternative energy source, you know, the development of any kind of alternative energy source?
Well, our foundation is dedicated to developing alternative energy sources that are human-scaled, efficient, environmentally friendly, and all of that. But the lion's share of our work certainly is, as our foundation developed, is towards understanding this Great Pyramid. We think understanding how the thing pumped water was more important than understanding how the stones were cut, because twice as many people that died at 9/11 die every day because they don't have clean water to drink and they can't irrigate their crops. Two 9/11s every day. And what we want to do is reduce the number of those people that that die every day. That's a function of and a purpose of our mission statement. So that's what we're about. Besides just a book and that type of thing, we're behind all of that is the foundation and the development of technologies. A lot of technologies we use now are from ancient times. The Baghdad battery, you know, they had a battery way back when. But we use similar technology.
But they only used it for electroplating, you know.
Well,
just electroplating.
Yeah, ha ha ha. Yeah, that's actually an evidence that has survived, but they may have used it for medical purposes, to power scientific machinery, to do who knows. So the applications that these ancient geniuses were able to develop. So that's what we're trying to do, is tap in to the ancient geniuses who developed and built the Great Pyramid, and from their genius redevelop this ancient technology to help us in our modern, it's very modern world, but very troubled. So that's what we're all about, you know, and much of what we're talking about is detailed in great detail in the book with illustrations, that type of thing, and also our website has some information at www.thepump.org. So also a local, not to mention this, but a local museum near where we live here in southwestern Oregon is granting us museum space for some displays and that type of thing. So we're working on that too. So there's a lot going on.
Well, and I think, you know, the focus of the foundation and the work that you're doing is really important. You know, getting off of oil. There's a whole lot that has been developed, you know, not just, you know, back in the way old days, but in relatively recent times that mm-hmm. would be energy efficient, you know, get us off oil, and it just kind of gets squashed because of the whole mentality and reliance on oil, and we're not going to get into a whole conspiracy theory conversation about that whole thing.
Oh, darn it.
And
just
no, yeah. we only have about 5 minutes, so it's like, we can't go there. Although it would be a very interesting conversation, because I think we're kind of on the same page.
Yes.
And I just think that it's sad that, you know, it just gets pushed to the side, or, you know, like when I think of somebody like Tesla, you know, and his work, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, why, you know, it was just buried. I mean, there are people that have invented stuff or come up with stuff that have been, you know, like solar cells. I'm sorry, we knew about solar cells in the 70s. We've had a long time that we could have been developing in them to the size of a watch to power your car by now. We've made microchips that small from the size of an entire room mm-hmm. of computing power. Mm-hmm. I think it's just sad where they decide to focus technology. And I really applaud you for, you know, putting out the effort and energy of educating people and, you know, creating the momentum to start looking at some alternative ways of creating power.
True. Yeah, that's true. The last thing I want to say is this, you know, this will help, we believe, this will help everybody except the energy traders, you know, the people that sell energy. It won't help them. So, but everybody else, it will help. People will be able to develop smaller water pumps and have them in their own backyards. They don't need pyramids made out of stone, just passages and chambers made out of polypropylene and PVC valves, and develop a new world. With 2012 coming up, people understand that we're coming to a new beginning and a new understanding, and the old ways are going to be going away, and we're going to have a new world. And the question is the new world going to be just like we already have, only worse, or is it going to be based on new understandings, new priorities, new technologies? So that's what we're about, and the book discusses all these things in greater detail. So if anyone has any question, they can send us an email. We also have a phone number that people can call 24 hours a day. It's our message line. I'll give you that number, 541.
Go ahead.
Okay. It's area code 541-824-0032. And they can give us a call there. So, and if anyone
somebody
has
wanted
any questions,
to get a copy of the book, if somebody wanted to get a copy of the book, how can they get a hold of it?
They can just go to Amazon.com or anywhere books are sold, like Borders. And if they don't have one in stock, they can order you one. So, or you can go to our website. There's some interest in signed copies. I've donated some copies to the foundation that are signed, and they can go to our website to if they're interested in that. So, or just stop by and ask us a question.
You know, signed copies are always priceless.
Oh, they're fun. Yes. Well, great.
Well, excellent. So, do you have any new writing projects coming up for you, or was this one enough?
Oh, man. Oh, it was the hardest thing I ever did. First, we compiled all the research and then put it into a book. So, and it just came out this year, just a couple months ago. So, it's hot off the press, and it's a wonderful thing.
Great. Stephen, thank you so much for coming on the show. You've been a wonderful guest, and good luck with your endeavors and your organization. I wish you really the best of luck.
Thank you, Rita, for letting me on your show.
Well, that's Stephen Myers. His book is The Lost Technology.
Yes, Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
You know, I really have to play like the right sound clip in order for the right music to come up, not the commercial music, but the end music. But it's going to mess up. So anyway, that was Stephen Myers, The Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramids. His webpage is thepump.org. So if you haven't answered the question yet, who was the incredibly ancient Egyptian god who is the original god of the dead, and gone to Just Energy Radio, www.justenergyradio.com, and click the contact button and answer the question, you won't have a chance in. Anyway, next week, we're going to be talking about crop circles. We've never talked about crop circles on this show, and we're going to be talking with Suzanne Taylor, the Inside the Crop Circle Mystery. Anyway, I'm Dr. Rita Louise. This is Just Energy Radio. Thank you all for tuning into the show this week. If you enjoyed the programming, please do mark this show as a favorite. And we will talk to you again next week. And until then, be blessed.
Join host Dr. Rita Louise each week at this time for Just Energy Radio. Point your browser to www.justenergyradio.com for more show information and to contact Dr. Rita. Until next time, remember, it's all just energy.